coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for
Hey Everybody, Hey Kids Comics. We are your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. Jedi Cole, you out there?
I'm here.
Again, I think
I am here.
I got way too close to the intellectual lodestone when I was trying to say your name. I'm sorry about that. I had to get rid of that thing.
It happens when trying to voice my name out loud.
It's like
looking upon the countenance of Cthulhu or something.
It's like Voldemort.
It's like the worst Candyman. I can say it twice, but the third time I just can't bring myself to do it.
The love child of Candyman and Beetlejuice.
Oh wow!
Candy Juice? Can I call you Candy Juice?
You.
I prefer Beetleman.
Beetleman and Candy Juice, attorneys at law.
Was that one of those like Defiant? Wasn't Defiant the publisher of Beetleman and Candy Juice?
Yeah,
it was either Defiant or a
TV series in the 70s, and they had
that's
a
right. Yeah,
they had a donkey as a sidekick.
And it was Dickinson in a cameo.
Yeah.
Donkey as the sidekick.
Yeah, they had to take it everywhere in a trailer, and there was always a shtick written in where the donkey would spoil everything for the bad guy, distracting them just enough for justice to prevail. It was Stitch.
Candy Juice and Beetleman. Yep. Fighting crime. And the dulcet tones you hear there are the lady. Catherine Houston joins us tonight to lend her once again her intelligence that makes us all feel dumb,
which is helps in this one because this is like we're going to delve into the dumb, as it were.
Right, we're really
excited. In the most wonderful way.
We're really excited for issue 202. Cole, what's the title?
This is Tick Marks.
Toon.
What is that in reference to?
I think I really had in mind, of course, we're talking about the Tick of the brilliant NEC New England Comics Company's flagship book forever that became a cartoon, a live-action series, and is now on the cusp of being a live-action series again. And, of course, the Tick's creator, Ben Edlund. But it was kind of a like marks the spot or hitting the marks thing. So I originally working title was Ticked Off, and I didn't want to seem negative because you can't be negative around the Tick.
Ladies
no,
and gentlemen,
you can't.
Process.
Yeah, this is like inside the actor studio, but for crappy podcasts.
That's right. Yeah, basically, Andy has a whole stack of blue cards there,
and nothing is written on any of them.
That's right.
Nothing is written on any of them. You can take this. This is an elective. Catherine was discussing this earlier. You can take this course as an elective. You can audit this class.
University of Phoenix actually gives credit for this. So.
God, I wish they did.
I know.
So
copy
yes.
Copy and paste those
this
notes.
Your elective of last resort.
So yes, absolutely. We are talking about the Tick. I am very excited. I love the Tick. Was not a big. I didn't. Again, I'm just a small town boy living in a lonely world, so I wasn't too aware of the Tick's presence until the cartoon came out, and then kind of went back and realized that it was a character prior to. So, but I know you two are not in that category. That's
no,
just
no,
me.
No,
we were heavy into the whole comics scene when the Tick actually came out, and
well, it didn't hurt that we were working for Diamond at the time.
Well, there you go. It translates. It didn't hurt a bit.
No, not a bit. So, I mean, we got put in front of, or comics got put in front of us, we might never have discovered otherwise. So, yeah, it certainly didn't hurt. Plus, when you're working in that environment, you do tend to sort of become more aware of what's going on out there. I had a lot of comic knowledge about comics I didn't care about.
I
really should adopt that for this show after all these years.
You really should, but right now we're going to talk about the
That's right.
So, Catherine, how was you? Good Lord, what is happening to me? Eddie vampired my intelligence on our Halloween issue. Yeah. Now I can't come back. What was your...
Yeah, in a few days when you hear
the... Oh, my God. You mean the last show was with Medina? Oh.
Yes, well,
that's what's happening. This show is with Medina. Actually, when this airs, we kind of recorded them a little out of order, out of necessity. But
okay.
Just a few days on Halloween, be on the lookout on the 31st on Monday for the first annual... Hey, kids!
No,
Scotty.
Damn it, Cole! Not the Igor voice, man. What did I tell you about the Igor voice? So, what was your introduction to what was your door opening tick experience, Catherine? I guess that's my question.
Well, as Cole rightfully started it out, we did work for Diamond Comics at the time, and when you work in a comic distribution center, it's just like its own little encapsulated existence. It's like if you work in plumbing, you know far more about fixtures than normal people do.
Right.
It was the same with comics, especially during the 90s when there's this big comic boom and there's this huge influx of independent comics. Pretty much anybody who could afford to get their stuff printed did get it printed, whether it was any good or not. So you'd see a lot of really independent titles, and you had a lot of comic book stores popping up that wanted to get on the comic bandwagon, and they'd order just anything.
Nobody wanted to be left in the cold
right.
on the next Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Exactly. And since you referenced Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that's a really good point, because that was that same time where, ooh, Ninja Turtles made it. What about Radioactive Hamsters? What about Glow in the Dark?
We did the whole show about glow in the dark chicklets.
I want that
comic.
You see all this weird independent stuff come through, and of course you're being paid by the hour, so you stand there and flip through and look at most of it. And
your limitations is they can't come after us.
Come and get me, manager. So that's where, in answer to your question, we ran across the Tick, and the Tick was one of the most rare of comics. I read it and it actually made me laugh. It made me laugh. Tears would be coming out of my eyes, and it was this wonderful satirical. It's a standalone. It's supposed to be its own thing, but really the whole underlying thing of it is satire, kind of almost like AKA Futurama,
right?
In that it totally references a genre, makes fun of it, but in its own storyline, and I totally fell in love with it. And Cole, of course, has always been really supportive of what I like. And so he's like, okay, you like that? We're going to collect that. It makes you happy. So,
it wasn't just like, you know, just because it made you happy. It was actually a very good book. It wasn't just a conceit, because one of the things that the Tick did well, there were a lot of, a couple of things happened. You had the turtles inspiring what they inspired, the, you know, basically rip-offs or wannabes, but you also had a lot of parody comics were coming out. That was a big
parody
thing.
Yes, exactly.
There's a lot of parody, but what the Tick did brilliantly is skirt parody and combine. It wasn't just straight parody, like say Nat Rat, The Dark Nat Returns was a brilliant parody of Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns, in that it captured all of the beats and made fun of them
right.
in wonderful little ways, including doing something I never imagined, catching a sexual innuendo that I didn't realize was there until somebody made it more obvious. In the scene where Vicky Vale and Knox are talking about, Bruce Wayne's big bank roll and his, I forget what the other line is, but it's just such subtle innuendo. And so they had him like at the dinner party talking about, you know, how people want to come to his dinner parties for his enormous sausage and his great big meatballs. I'm like, I never realized that was subtle innuendo with the bank roll and I forget the other line, but you could kind of retroactively read into it. But, you know, that was great parody, but it was strictly parody. What The Tick did was parody things, but also told its own tales.
Right.
With compelling characters. So occasionally those characters would fall into a bit of storyline that was parody, but the parody itself was part of something larger.
Well, one of the funniest things in one of the earliest comics, in the earliest issues of it is Tick will jump from building to building and chunks of the building will fall off, you know, and showing how just the mindless destruction it is just for him to hop from building to building. And there's this one scene, and I believe it's been years since I read it, so bear with me, but this guy had come down and hit a flagpole. And of course, this is all drawn comic, and it's the flagpole, as a result of the impact, is going wub, 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 up and down. And it does this. It keeps doing that through the entire conversation. I don't do it justice telling it, but if you're reading it and you're reading the dialogue, but you're also watching this going on in the background, it's really funny.
It was the Tick. Basically, he'd fallen off of a building, and he imagines he's just going to spring cat-like off of this flagpole, which then, you know, catches under his arm and goes with him.
Yes.
And so the whole time, he lands and he crashes like hip deep into the asphalt. And he's talking to this homeless guy, and throughout the entire conversation, the thing is still vibrating from the impact. And it's just wonderfully subtle, because they'll go by, you know, they'll do the cinematic back and forth between the characters, and then you see the little onomatopoetic yub, 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 the whole time, and then you see that the thing is in Doppler, like Jack Kirby with Thor's hammer. It is such a wonderfully subtle scene, and even when he gets out of the hole he made and leaves the thing behind, it's still rattling away on the ground in his absence, because it was struck that hard. And that really, the artist and writer, I'm glad Catherine brought that up, because it's a great lead-in to Ben Edlund, who created The Tick. Because a lot of guys were creating characters, and there was some clever stuff. But Ben Edlund hit more marks than I think anybody. He was in that element. He showed his genius as both an artist and a writer.
Well,
there was nobody else involved.
In my view, like, so for me, The Tick is a comic book for comic book fans.
Yes.
And it was created by a comic book fan. And if you read into Ben Edlund, you find out that that's absolutely, he created the character as a mascot for his local comic shop. That's how The Tick got started. But
Let me jump in real quick and intercede, because I absolutely adore the origin of The Tick.
Okay.
Not the origin of the character of The Tick, but where the idea came from. It was from a group of guys playing football in a vacant lot or open field. You know, just guys hanging out and having a fun, you know, friendly game of football. And there was somebody involved who wasn't normally part of the group, like somebody who came with somebody, like Silent Bob's cousin from Russia.
Right, Berserker.
Yeah, Berserker, exactly. So, but apparently this guy was unstoppable. Like, three or four guys would try to tackle him, and he would just sort of trudge along with them hanging off of him. And somebody said, this guy's like a tick. You just can't crush him.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And, of course, being the creative type that Edlund was, he immediately created the image of this character called the Tick. It's like a superhero. And then it snowballs from there. But I wanted to pay a little tribute to the fact that some unknown, some guy was a catalyst, much like Al Simmons, only without Twitter.
only without the sad, sad backstory.
That's a shallower cut there, but it is a deep cut.
But so when I say that, What I mean is, first of all, like you were saying, I went back and read issues of The Tick after I saw the cartoon, and you know, I absolutely loved it. It's great. It's it's a comic book for comic book fans. But when it was released, I think we were all suffering from, as comic book fans, suffering from this kind of false intellectualism that was being introduced into comics. Exactly. Everybody started taking comics real seriously. And
well, that's around the same time, if I'm not mistaken, that Batman really started to get dark.
Yeah, they darkened up Batman. Punisher was getting his thing. Wolverine was cutting, was the best at what he did, you know, and that was chewing bubble gum, and he's all out of whatever.
It turned out he was even getting better.
Right.
What he did.
Right. Exactly.
Like, people think when you reach the pinnacle of what you're doing, there's nowhere else to go. And Wolverine.
Best is a relative term.
Yeah. In that period, he just got even better at being the best.
It's a sliding scale. It really is.
It really is.
But so you get a comic book like The Tick, which is very smartly written, but it proceeds to skewer all of the false intellectualism that's being introduced into comic books, where he never takes his costume off ever. He destroys buildings and he doesn't care. Like, you know, it's part of being the Tick. You know, he enlists the help of his sidekick Arthur just because that's destiny. That's destiny calling. You will answer the call of destiny. This is it. You know, and all of these comic book tropes are being turned on their head in a very, very intelligent, fun way that if you just pick it up and read it, it's very funny. But if you're a comic book fan and you read it, it makes complete sense.
He's just completely oblivious.
Yes. That was the thing. If ignorance is bliss, then oblivion must be nirvana.
Right.
Yes. Yes. I'm so stealing that quote.
That's great.
I'm just going to Tea Fury right now.
Can you get my Presbyterian shirt from the Halloween episode made while we're at it?
That is brilliant. Say it again, Cole.
If ignorance is bliss, then oblivion is nirvana.
I'm going off track here for a second, but we've all seen Luke Cage at this point. We're going to do a show on Jessica Jones and Luke Cage very, very soon. But there is a
Cage
scene.
Match.
There's a scene in the show. It's about middle of the show where I can't remember who it is that's talking, but says to Luke Cage, don't forget who you are. And in my head, all I can think of is Mufasa. like this just became, damn it, Disney, get your fingers out of everything.
That's right.
But yeah, no, I and in that respect, in the respect that it is a comic book reader, a comic book fan's book, right? It's very challenging. It challenges you to let go of all of these preconceived notions that you have about comics and how serious they are and about how the world needs to be applied and continuity. Nobody gives. They don't care. Who cares?
Yeah.
It's the Tick. Who cares? And you're inside. There's a part of your brain screaming about it. Like, no, no, that can't happen because 2 issues ago this happened. Who cares? Like, that's
And also, I totally agree with you. And one of the things that kind of, you know, in the comics, Oppenheimer Clark Oppenheimer was the wink to Superman.
Right, right, yes.
Okay, and Tick was the crossword puzzle editor at the same paper where Clark was a reporter.
Which is brilliant.
Or Oppenheimer.
Brilliant, by the way.
And Tick really wanted to be Oppenheimer's friend. He really, Oppenheimer just hated him. Probably for the same reason, you know, you were talking about trying to force logic and reason into crime fighting. It's like, no, we just do it because you do it. And he wanted to be Oppenheimer's buddy, so he folded Oppenheimer's car into an ashtray as a gift.
As a gift, because why not? Because he's the Tick. Cole, what were you saying?
Speaking of just the Superman notes in that one issue, and what's wonderful is Edlin had the smarts to not just turn this into the Tick jumps from parody to parody to parody.
Right.
He smartly parodied when it made good sense. sense and let it be its own thing in other ways. I mean, obviously, what was it? Oedipus was her name. Was a nod to Elektra.
Yes. Yes.
She was like the rich girl who went to ninja school. Oh, yeah, they need to do that. We went to, like, ninja school. And they played very heavily on the ninja craze, because ninjas were all the rage. The first few issues kind of play that out a little bit. And then you go into the Caped Wonder storyline, which was layers upon layers upon layers. Every Superman fan should seek out this story, because it's so layered, from basically the superhero that he becomes is known as the Caped Wonder.
Right.
Which is a wonderful nod to Donner's Superman.
Yes.
And the city stunning that he did. Then you have the Clark Oppenheimer jokes are rife with, there's nods to the television Superman, because the Jimmy Olsen character is constantly referring to the Perry White character. And he's like, you know, yes, tyrannical overlord. He's, stop calling me that.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He's not. Okay.
And then when
for the love of God, go get one of these comics and dial and turn to the page where the Jimmy Olsen corollary. Because the look on his face is the look that somebody would have on their face, where if they're locked up with a mass murderer and they're just trying to keep them happy so they won't die.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing that Ben Edlund does beautifully as an artist, he's one of those. There's a lot of great artists in comics who get a lot of press. Ben Edlund was actually one of the best artists at drawing the human figure that ever lived, because he could draw human beings doing things and you knew exactly what they were doing. At one point, Clark Oppenheimer loses his glasses and does the finger glasses. And you know that's what he's doing. You don't have to have that explained to him. He just looks up at the Tick with doing the finger glasses.
Well, it's almost like, okay, so it's very easy, like you were saying, to just consider the Tick satire, right? It's very easy to say, oh, well, this is a satire book. But the problem with that is, it's almost as if all these books exist, right? Let's say Superman exists in DC, and Tick just walks into the comic and starts calling people out. Like, hey, Superman, I saw you last week. You think those glasses are fooling anybody? Like, you know, Jimmy Olsen, you're going to turn into a giant turtle. Lois Lane, yeah, how does it feel being boinked by Superman every day? I'm the Tick, and just walks off, and everybody's like, no, what? Let's just pretend that didn't happen. I don't know what that was. And he
How do you backpedal out of that? Yeah,
and like, you're stupid, walks into Batman. You're stupid, walks into Spider-Man, you know? And that's the thing. It's like, just pointing
it's
out
like
the ridiculousness
it's like that,
of these
the
characters.
It's like the reel of the Creature from the Black Lagoon smashing stuff. And it's like, F this guy and F that bird.
Right, it's like, but it's
well,
just...
Toward the end of the comic run, he runs across, I guess, what ultimately is supposed to be the Batman corollary. I mean, I know you've got Der Fledermaus and all that, but I don't think...
But that wasn't... The Fledermaus later Batman Well did not appear in the comics, so you're on the right track.
Okay, but he runs across a guy, for those of you who haven't read the comic, a guy who superheroes by the name of Tick, and he's got the whole Batman setup. He's got all the gadgets in the cave.
He has the
and
Tick
the,
crevice.
Yeah, yeah.
The Tick loves. Crevice! That's gross. That is a gross title.
The cave and the tick cocker and all that
crap.
He has
a shield that's shaped like a tick with eight limbs coming off of it. He has a tick cycle and a tick car and a tick tank and this you know, like the trophy room and everything you want from your Batman character. It's Barry Hubris, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, and, that's and, right. Yes.
And Barry gets pissed off at the Tick for it says, you know, two people can't practice under the same name. Well, apparently the code of heroes, what we learned from this is the code of heroes is they have to fight it out with each other, and the winner takes all. So
not just the name, but everything.
Yeah, needless to say, the Tick just annihilates him and ends up with all of his stuff.
So yeah, he and ultimately he and Arthur retire to the Tick crevice.
Yeah.
To take up residence there, and drives Barry Hubris even more insane than he already was. But yeah, what was wonderful about that was there was a sense of the kind of Screen Actors Guild rules,
right, right,
being applied to superheroes. And it would also, in a way, whether intentionally or not, whether by accident or design, as I often say, what you got there was sort of a nod to what gives us many, many years later, it gives us this curious, we can't call Netflix's series Daredevil. We have to call it, and I kid you not, I saw this in print repeatedly in an article, Marvel's Marvel's Punisher, rather.
Yes.
Talking about Marvel's Punisher has, you know, cast these characters who will be, these actors who will play this character in Marvel's Punisher. And everybody loves the, I forget the actor who plays the Punisher, I'm sorry, Marvel's Punisher. And I think in many ways it predicts that sort of necessity of...
I thought it was a reference to actually the Captain Marvel brouhaha.
Well, I think that's where it started, I think, actually. But
well, in fact, Michael Price, who was... I was talking to him about the character he worked on, The Prowler.
Right.
Okay.
Back in the very period we're talking about, when The Prowler was being published, there was a Spider-Man character called The Prowler that Marvel didn't care about. And then in the meantime, in the ensuing years, that character started being, like so many do, writers will go and find these obscure characters, haven't seen the light of day, bring them to the forefront, all of a sudden they're the hot thing, they got the action figures, they got the t-shirts and the socks and what have you. And then, very recently, Michael and the other people who were involved, they're trying to go back and restore and publish The Prowler. And he said that they were getting some pushback from Marvel and had to, I forget what the character's real name was, so they released their compilation as, you know, such and such, The Prowler.
That's, and the one that gets me.
And the Marvels thing, you don't see that on every character. And since Andy and I collect action figures.
Oh, this, yes, that's what I was getting ready to say.
It's hilarious to see, like, you know, common words are fine sometimes. And then sometimes it's like, you know, Black Cat is fine, but it has to be Marvel's Tiger Shark.
Yeah, Marvel.
Why is it Marvel Tiger? Why, what happened? Tiger Shark is a word that predates Marvel and who cares? But there's some sort of weird legal dichotomy.
The one that it always gets me, like on those figures, and I'm looking at one right now, it'll say at the top of the packaging, Marvel Comics or Marvel Legends Universe, whatever, and then Marvel's The Punisher. Like, we get it. Everybody gets it. You can put down the torch of the pitchfork. Everybody gets it. But yes, that's absolutely what, but if we're talking about
some sort of little brilliant subtlety to that I just loved was the fact that it very much struck me as, you know, a SAG type of thing at the time, but I think it kind of predicted where things were going, or perhaps showed a foreknowledge of how ridiculous it was going to become.
Don't forget that that Barry Hubris had an Ace the Bat Hound too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. He had a Tick Hound.
And what was the name? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh.
And the name of the dog was Host. So he was the Tick.
Oh, that's right. And again, that was the other thing. As a writer, Ben Edlin could weave so many subtle jokes into things.
Ben First Ideas Edlin. I'm pretty sure that these almost had to be. I can imagine, like, this is just, he's like, what am I named dog? Oh, we'll name him
off
the Host.
The
Let's go with
head.
It. We're not going to, nope. Yeah. Should we focus
no
group this? Nope. Let's just do it. It's like, okay. It's just like, all right, Ben, go for it. So that's pretty much the Tick. Now, I think that we have to, at this point, talk about the cast of characters, the inspirational cast of characters that exist, because there's so many brilliant, just, I think it probably has to make Cole jealous with the amount of tongue-in-cheek characters that he was able to concoct short order.
It's funny because that type of parody opens doors. Because you don't have to have, I mean, if you came out with The Punisher, that sounds hip and sexy and marketable, but you have a hard time marketing characters who have silly names, and when you do something that takes place in a silly universe, it's open season on names.
Well, I mean, who in their right mind comes up with Baby Boomerangatang? Like, just comes up, that's such a brilliant, and then goes, you know what this guy will be? A guy in an orangutan costume with a bunch of baby doll boomerangs strapped around his waist. Like, who does that?
I mean, that is literally right up there with some of the characters I had come up with. It was just conceptually trying to, when we wind up with our ever-growing Muggerville 7, it's the same sort of thing where you're just like, you take a joke and then you take it that next step further. Like knowing Eddie and Colleen doing the Figments and also Russell the Toyminator, I became familiar with the one of the many type of Sasquatch creatures out there, the Skunk Ape.
Sure.
And I thought that'd be a brilliant villain. And it's just basically a guy wearing a Spirit the Halloween Store gorilla costume that he's painted two white stripes on the back of, a la the cat from the Pepe Le Pew thing.
Yeah.
Just basically taking an off-the-rack gorilla costume, painted a couple of stripes down the back.
Nice.
And goes out and calls himself the Skunk Ape.
So,
well, I've got a question for you guys. I know there's a bazillion of them, but you brought up other characters. Can you think of one in particular that you really like, either evil or nice?
The funny thing is, because you have so much to draw from, I'm racking my brain to separate all of the incarnations, because each one brought so many new and wonderful characters to the fore.
Well, I don't think you should.
You get to cite related ones, I guess.
Oh, yeah. We're gonna talk about all the incarnations, trust me. We're not going to, just because this is a comic show, we're never afraid to talk about movies and TV and whatever. So, Andy, go ahead and if you've got a favorite, because I'm going to have to try to mentally whittle it down.
Well, for me, it was always, because it's the nonchalant insanity of the Tick that I always really liked. So for instance, if there was I'm not citing this, but Chairface Chippendale, who's like the bad guy, right? Like if he formed a super group, a bunch of bad guys would show up for no reason. Like in a comic book, you've got to have like the Sinister Six has to have a reason, or there needs to be the Legion of Doom has to have a reason. Not in this. Uh-huh. Just show up. Just join. Who cares? Right? We're bad guys is what we do. But for me, it's for sheer insanity's sake, it's Man-Eating Cow. And by far is my favorite, just because it makes no sense. It makes there is no sense to this character existing, yet there it is. You know, and the Man-Eating Cow is somewhere between a good guy and a bad guy, but it's a woman, but it's a kid, because it's a cow, it's not a bull, obviously. Yeah. You know, but it's a cow that eats people, that's also an anti-hero, but still shows up on bad guy groups sometimes, but helps the Tick occasionally. Like it's so insane that it makes total sense in that universe, and that's even more insane, you know.
When the Tick moved to New York, he left the city in the care of Man-Eating Cow.
Exactly. Like, what? Think about this. Think about the sentence you just said, and that absolutely defines why I love the Tick. Because when the Tick left for New York, he left the care of the city to the Man-Eating Cow. Is exactly why I love the Tick. There's no other reason that is necessary. I love the Man-Eating Cow because it makes no sense. Like there's no real kind of cipher for that. Like Chairface Chippendale was a gangster mob boss. You know, you had all these kind of allegories for other characters. Man-Eating Cow just is insane, and that's why I love Man-Eating Cow. There's so many great characters, but I love Man-Eating Cow. It's just my favorite.
Well, rightfully so, because the story of redemption. I mean, Man-Eating Cow was just simply thrown into a pit of man-eating alligators and cows that Chairface Chippendale had to dispose of his enemies with.
His rancor pit.
Plug.
Well, that's the Rancor pit.
Oh, sorry.
That was a trap. That's all that was.
Right here on the JCU, and the first and third Sunday of every month on Watch On Air Live, it's the Rancor Pit Live.
You're like Tony Randall and Eagle Snack.
That was some Good Morning Vietnam shit, is what that was.
And now I'm gonna play Wonderful World.
What is your favorite Tick character?
I want to point out though, you brought up Chairface Chippendale, because that was another place where Tick would wax and wane from parody to its own thing, because the Chair-Faced Chippendale was a wonderful wink at one of the icons of comics was Dick Tracy.
Right.
And Chair-Face and his gang were basically the rogues gallery of Dick Tracy, because you had like Zipper Neck and the Pineapple Pocopo and the guy that looks exactly like Peter Lorre.
You had Devin Ugly in there, just right in the name. Just
yeah. The brow or something like that. The crease, that was it.
The crease, the cleft was in there. It was
yeah, exactly. So that was a wonderful thing.
It's plus like these days they would have had a ironing implement as a head and Iron Maiden.
Right. Yeah, like anything. Like, but that was the great thing is there. None of it was buried in the. They didn't bury the lead like they did, you know, in Dick Tracy. They tried to be clever. This was just not. That's, again, why be clever when you can just say what it is?
Like, say what it is. Just be boils, because you just have a lot of boils. But, gosh, from the comics themselves, because it's very hard, because I really adore characters from the cartoon and the television show.
I think you could use either, and we could use that as a transition into the TV show.
I think
show.
One of my favorite from the cartoon has to be the irrepressible sewer urchin.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Because the sewer urchin is as close to a kindred spirit to the tick as you're likely to find.
Right.
It's almost like the fact that the sewer urchin was already there. He sort of was the trailblazer that allowed the tick to show up in the city and do his thing.
Well, he was like a Rain Man spoof, wasn't he?
Oh, or... yeah. He was very much designed to invoke a Rain Man kind of character, you know, especially the time when they were trying to find where the tick had disappeared to. And, of course, he was in charge of checking the sewers. And he comes up out of a manhole and they're like, did you find anything? No, I definitely didn't find the tick, but I found a lovely pie. And, of course, the flight pass is like, oh. Found a pie. And he's holding an entire pie. Not just like a dripping slice or anything. It's a whole pie.
And I do love the fact that his power is literally just to shut people down with this smell. Like, they can't deal with it. It's so good. So good.
The costume is brilliant. And that is one of the things, you can feel the touch of Ben Edlund in every incarnation, and you can tell when he leaves it.
Yeah.
If he left.
Yeah. So that's a good Catherine, what about yours? Because
okay,
you have
I'm company, so I get to pick two.
Okay, I like it. I like it.
My first is probably hang on.
Well, while Catherine's doing that, I just want to say Sheila Eel. Which is fucking
Sheila
brilliant.
Eel. The thing is, until someone said it out loud, which was you and just now,
You didn't put it together. So good.
Sorry, I was having audio problems.
That's
there.
Okay. We talked about Sheila Eel while you were gone.
Well, that's nice.
We're back.
Okay. I liked in the cartoon. I loved American Maid.
Oh yes.
Who I think in the live action ultimately was replaced by Captain Liberty. And she's obviously the Wonder Woman corollary. And I love Der Fledermaus.
Oh, so good. So good.
And he was replaced by Batman Well in the
which is so
Nestor
funny.
Nestor Carbonell was the only... That character was the only one in the live action, the original live action, that could steal scenes from Patrick Warburton.
Yes.
So funny. Just.
Yes. And just unflappably vain.
Yes.
And so confident. It was just.
He would refer to himself in the third person. What size are you? I'm Ben Manuel size.
Oh my God! But yes, and his best line is when he's chiding Captain Liberty for her indiscretion. He says, "You killed him with your little pink secret."
There's so much.
Oh,
there's so much to talk about. Like, okay, so let's move on to the cartoon now, because the cartoon and then leading into the live action stuff, I've never seen anything translate as well into a cartoon as the Tick did.
It was It was brilliantly, and the thing about the Tick, and I think this is important to say, leading into all of the future incarnations, is it was a smartly written book. The thing I think a lot of people who try to write parody or comedy don't realize is comedy isn't just a bunch of goofy stuff.
Right.
Effective comedy is incredibly smart.
Exactly.
And effective parody is incredibly smart. And Ben Edlund is incredibly smart as a writer. And you see that in all of these incarnations initially. If he's involved, you get some really smart stuff.
I agree. When he left the comic, man, you could really tell.
Mm-hmm. And but only in the... in the TV show, in the live action show, do you get stuff like the Deertown Aztecs? Do you remember the Deertown Aztecs?
Oh, wow. Which was... we're not that far back in. We started watching the live, we started watching the live action, but no, I'd forgotten the Deertown Aztecs.
When you take a guy who looks at the, you know, the Alive movie, the story of the soccer team that crash lands in the Andes, and
yes,
and you put it into the mind of Ben Edlund, you get the Deertown Aztecs, which was a baseball, like a grade school baseball team that crashed at Machu Picchu and became like native, like went native and became Aztecs. Like, you get just brilliant, weird things like that that come out of left field. And
they're the things that happen when you are smart and you think too much about things.
Right,
and
for
sure. And start
to
put different things together that don't belong together because they're all colliding in your head.
Yes, you get the Deertown Aztecs, for God's sakes. Oh, my God, so good. So what did you guys watch the cartoon when the cartoon?
We were working at Diamond when the cartoon first aired. Everybody... Monday morning was talking about Saturday's Tick.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It was like back in the early 80s when everyone would be talking about Twin Peaks. Uh-huh. Hey, it was weird, but you know. And speaking to that very fact and to the intelligence of the writing of that show, I love discovering new things. And this was one I felt like, wow, I missed it. I missed my chance to discover something new. There was an exchange between American Maid and Deflator Mouse. And one of the guys at work said, yeah, I had to go look up that word she used. I didn't even think to question what that even meant. You know, insulting each other. And he calls her a jingoist.
Oh, yeah.
In a cartoon, by the way.
In a cartoon, yes. And he went and looked up and found out that jingoist is like a hyper-patriot. Someone who just, you know, is a flag waving, you know, bleeds the color of the flag.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, it never occurred to me to even question what that word was. It was just all so much in the moment. And I thought, damn it, this is even smarter than I realized as a show. And so that's why you get things like the Deertown Aztecs, because you have someone willing to have one character call another a jingoist as an insult.
And you in the cartoon, but you get that stuff, but then you also get the evil midnight bomber what bombs at midnight.
Which you could never do again.
No, you would that would never fly.
That one will never be aired again.
No, you're right. You're right. They can never air that. That's going to be on one of those Star Wars holiday special tapes at conventions somewhere.
Like
at this
17th
point.
Generation VHS. Yeah, and it'll be like.
I don't know though. I think in about 10 more years. I think in about 10 more years you'd be able to do it again, because I think
sensibilities will have died down a bit.
Well, a generation would have passed. See, 20 or 25 years is a generation, right?
Right, right.
And we need to be a generation past the things that hurt us the most before we can bring things back in the popular culture and then be okay. So I think give it another decade and you'll be able to do it.
But like, I don't even know what the evil midnight bomber, what bombs at midnight, because you have to say his whole name. You can't just the evil midnight bomber. Like,
it's like Cartman with I'm Sailing Away.
I don't know what he was representing, what he was satire against.
Were things that were just purely Edlund.
Yeah, that's
you know,
true.
That's the thing is you can look for satire in everything, and you're going to be hard pressed to match maybe more than 35 to 40% of what content was there was something.
Most of it was
pure Edlin, just parodying everything, or just being funny, or just having a character with an outrageous name because it has an outrageous name.
Yeah,
I saw it as the ultimate joke of a character naming themselves so blatantly, you know, what they are.
It's like an exaggerated version of the Shocker from Spider-Man.
There you go.
Right.
It's like, you know, if somebody runs in and says, I'm the Shocker, then you immediately go grab the hose there for
exactly. It's the ultimate giveaway of you give yourself.
Somebody comes in and says, you know,
your name.
Right.
I'm the Speckled Owl. Well, maybe they fly. Maybe they just like the name. I don't know what. It's kind of a wild card. I better
be
careful with
this one. What they don't do is swim, you know?
Yeah. Or maybe they like spit acid at PETA.
But like you can naturally assume.
I spit acid. The hell?
You can naturally assume that the evil midnight bomber what bombs at midnight is A, evil, B, a bomber, and C, probably bombs at midnight. So
there you go.
It's like Two-Face, you know, if there's some sort of duplicit crime going on, it's probably Two-Face.
He doesn't sell fake art.
Right, he's not
do online scams.
He's not an upstairs man. He's, yeah. So how did they move the cartoon to the, because I know we want to talk about the TV show, because the TV show was Patrick Warburton's representation. I think that Patrick Warburton was born to play the Tick.
And in fact, Absolutely. In every role I've ever seen him after that, he's just been the Tick.
Right. So, like, how did that play out? Do you think that they realized that this, okay, so the cartoon, you know, I think more adults watch the cartoon than kids.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And the thing about it is the cartoon was written with that in mind.
Right.
It was, they brilliantly recognized that they told tales that kids could enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But they were so rife with jokes for the adults. Like my favorite, absolute favorite episode is Dinosaur Neil.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Because it is so full of wonderful innuendo, of wonderful subtle little jokes, and just little things that are smart, like when they determine that it's acetylsalicylic acid that will bring him back to normal, so they have to go make this gigantic aspirin to force down his gullet, and when they deliver it to the assembled military, Arthur's explaining that it's a giant aspirin, then pauses a moment to explain the origins of aspirin, that the ancient Egyptians would boil white willow leaves as an analgesic, and it was discovered that the byproduct was acetylsalicylic acid, which is the active ingredient of aspirin. But aspirin is powerful medicine, so should only be used under the advice of a doctor or a parent. And the general who is in command there just pipes in, "That's good advice." It's just like, you have this momentary Shakespearean aside, and the general brings you back into the story with, "That's good advice."
Like, it was like a combination of Animaniacs and G.I. Joe.
Right.
Exactly. It is, you know, one part frantic, one part intelligent, one part just, you know, mindless fun. And, you know, and then, like, Tick having to wrestle Dinosaur Neil's tongue. And after he's restored, Neil asks him, you know, when you he's actually having misgivings.
Yeah.
His principal concern isn't the capital,
destruction?
Yeah, it isn't the
collateral damage.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. Collateral damage. It's his misgivings about having another person inside his mouth. It's like, when you were in my mouth wrestling my tongue, was that weird or anything? I love the response. Unique, Neil. Unique.
Was it unexpected?
Kids aren't going to get wonderfully the joke is and what the purpose was, the idea of him just being concerned about, you know, like, you know, was it weird when we were in having to share the same sleeping bag because it was so cold up in the mountains and I got an erection or something like
that.
Yeah,
it's that scene in every movie where they're like, it's too cold, the only way we can survive is if we strip naked and huddle for warmth, and it's that awkward, like,
yeah. And you have to, you know, address that later.
Yeah, it will like, come up. It will come up.
Yeah.
Or you'll be like, oh, see you on the other side.
But the the live action show, I remember the first episode of the live action show, watching it and thinking to myself, this is less a superhero TV show, which, by the way, was not like it is now, where there's two superhero TV shows on every night of the week.
You have this and maybe Mantis.
This is Seinfeld with slightly more costumes. That's what this is.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
And it's brilliant. And it's friggin' brilliant. Like, that's,
I agree with you. I think you nailed it, Andy. I mean, today, there's so many superhero live action things going on that are actually really good.
Yeah.
But then it was a groundbreaker, or among the groundbreakers. And I think that's the reason that it didn't survive, is because the people who did the programming didn't really know how to handle it.
Oh, sure. Of course.
The principal reason it didn't survive is because it was during that period when Fox was still a pretty young network.
Right. Right.
And they would buy anything. And then they would get home with it and realize, well,
they pick it up at the bar and then be like,
it doesn't
that
go with
perfect.
Yeah, they would go into the Southwestern motif living room with those weird, you know, like found wood ladders and the coyote with the neckerchief cutouts and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this doesn't go here because it's more sort of Victorian. And then they would go room to room to room. And that's one of the things that killed it, is Fox didn't know what they had on their hands, so they buried it. They would show two episodes 1 week and then wouldn't air anything for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And they would air it on Monday 1 week and Thursday the next and Tuesday the next week. And then they would say, oh, well, obviously nobody's watching.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, it's like picking up the girl at the bar after you just got out of a relationship, not knowing what you want, bringing her, you know, and then you end up in a relationship with her and realize that you had, you know, while she's awesome, she doesn't, you know, she's not in the same place in life that you are. So what do you do? Like you ignore her until she goes away. That's pretty much
it's
it.
Not like,
plus, you didn't really anticipate having to maintain the "I am an astronaut" lie for 6 months.
Right, right, right. I'm hip. I'm with it. I skateboard. I like Go-Gurt. What?
Like, Bill, you hate Go-Gurt.
Shut up. Don't ruin this for me, man. Don't ruin this. She does Pilates.
Pilates? I thought that was like frozen Go-Gurt.
Right? You mean I didn't have to like Go-Gurt? Damn it. Damn it, Bill. Where were you 6 months ago? Well, I was telling you that this wasn't the show you should pick up. You should probably have left it.
6 months ago, you fell on deaf ears. But yeah, they had oftentimes, there were many a show during that period, none of which, others which I can cite at the moment, but Fox just pretty much, if it wasn't The Simpsons, they didn't know where they wanted it.
Right.
And they didn't know how to program, and they didn't know how to leave something well enough alone to let it find its audience. Its audience had to find it because they never knew where it was going to be.
Right, right.
And probably before it was all over, it probably started giving it a bunch of bad advice anyway.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and then they were like, oh, no, it went away.
Yeah.
There were several episodes that were never, at least one that was never aired. And they also, once it was compiled, you found out that they were shown out of order.
Oh, of course. Fox was
showed the pilot after they showed the second episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fox was notorious for showing shows. I think they've corrected that mistake recently.
I think they thought they were syndicated.
Well,
they bought Happy Days, and they would show 5 episodes from season 4, and then they would show you an episode from season 9.
Right. And
you're like, what the hell happened to Richie?
Like, when did Chachi get a beard? I don't know what happened.
Why does that guy leg keep appearing and disappearing?
No. Yes. I'll allow it.
Definitively, who the hell owns that damn burger joint?
Right?
Some days it's the little Asian guy. Some days it's the fat Italian guy. I like them both fine. Make up your mind.
Oh, gosh.
Does Joni love Chachi or not? I don't know.
How does he keep getting the motorcycle in the house?
So, yeah, it was very much like when shows go into syndication and the programming directors don't know how to read, like they didn't learn Dewey Decimal or something. And like, you know, what's this here? S3, E4. Oh, that sounds like a good one. That's season 3, episode 4, Bill. Hey, look, don't you talk to me about this. You tried to talk me out of my girlfriend and her Pilates.
You ruined my life.
That's right. So, said, I'm going out for Pilates. I said, I want chocolate. It all fell apart.
That's right. I don't even know what Go-Gurt is. I can't even change my own oil. Why'd you trust me to pick this show?
You seeing this stuff? Looks like melted bubble gum. Anyway.
I take my shirt off. I look like a melted candle. You let me go out with Pilates, girl. I had a perfectly good Survivor over here I could have picked up.
So there you have it. That was The Fate. And I was very happy when it did come out, because one of the best episodes of a live action show, if you've not, you know, if you don't own or haven't rented the live action, the compiled, the complete first season, only season, the Terror.
Oh. Which
never aired. Was one of the single where the Tick calls out this 108-year-old supervillain who doesn't even know what year it is. And he just keeps hounding him and just gets him to the point where he comes out of retirement because he's so pissed off. And has one of the best lines is from the Terror. He's like, I'll fold you in my wallet and spend you on a whore. And we recently started watching those again, and I had forgotten that line, and I absolutely love that.
Well, and if you look, okay, so post this, a lot of this spun out, the idea for this show has been, kind of been kicked around for a while, this particular issue of Hey Kids Comics, but a lot of the... We picked up a lot of momentum when I was just dicking around on Amazon one day, and they said that the pilot season was out for Amazon, and one of the shows was The Tick. And I'm like, no, really? Okay. And welcome back, Ben Edlund, because holy hell, it was brilliant.
Okay, the thing about it is, when Andy contacted me, he's like, holy crap, they're coming out with The Tick, a new live-action series. I'm like, funny thing, The Tick has this awkward history with the world. I said, I knew that. I knew that like 6 or 7 months ago when it was announced that there was a live-action Tick in production.
Right.
And then nothing.
Right.
Not even so much as a whisper, oh, by the way, or anything. It was over. And I'm like, oh, I guess that never happened.
Right.
And
right.
It was like, what is this? It's like when Hitchcock shot the birds.
And my favorite thing about the new show, in reference to what we were talking about earlier with the Tick just walking into other show or other, yeah, walking into Superman and saying, you're stupid, you're stupid, you're stupid, and then walking out of panel and into Batman and saying, you're stupid, you're stupid, you're stupid.
Right.
And just kind of pointing out the ridiculousness that exists is that the new show, so the old show was kind of the bright and shiny Keystone City idea of a superhero show, right? Like it was, everything was polished, it was super shiny, it was definitely the mid-90s idea of what a show like that should look like.
Right.
Yeah.
This one is dark and gritty, and the new show's all dark, all gritty, like as if it was one of the Netflix superhero shows, kind of. Except it's, the Tick is still the Tick.
Yeah, it actually speaks very much to its time. I think it recognizes it can't go back to being strictly what other incarnations of the Tick were, because each of them spoke to their own time very beautifully.
Exactly.
The cartoon, the original comic, each incarnation. And one of the things I love is that Ben Edlund is somebody after my own heart, because he, like myself, will reuse the same material or use every part of the joke, yeah, as I often say. And what's brilliant is he gets away with it, because every incarnation of the Tick effectively starts the same way, but there's wonderfully subtle nuances. Arthur is always an accountant in a moth suit that's mistaken for a bunny suit.
Right.
maybe in the latest incarnation, because with those sort of feathery looking antenna, it's definitely more moth-like in the costume choices. But I loved, like in the cartoon, the wonderful little subtle changes and twists. like Mickey Dolenz voicing Arthur brilliantly in the cartoon, when he's agonizing after he's quit his job as an accountant to become a superhero, is, you know, how's he going to cover the cost of living? How does he? How do you even make ends meet as a superhero? And he's there thinking, and I love this dialogue. It's like, I can reverse my underwear to get an extra day.
Right.
What the heck? This is a cartoon.
Well, I loved it. If you watch the pilot, how Arthur gets his suit, you know, it's so Tick. It's such a Tick thing where, you know, it's this super like this Iron Man type super suit that's being developed, you know, and it ends up, I think, being stolen by the bad guys, and the Tick inadvertently, being the Tick, stumbles upon this super suit, brings it to Arthur because it's Arthur's destiny to be the Tick's sidekick, drops the suit in his lap, and Arthur puts it on, and of course it's the moth suit, and
exactly.
And it's just like, this is yours now. Or when Arthur wakes up and Tick's just in his bed.
Yeah, that was the best.
But the whole time you've got this, every other character, almost without fail, has this kind of Netflix-y dark undertone. You know, this Luke Cagey, Matt Murdock-y undertone, except for the Tick, who's just pacing around on top of the, and all of the, like, the weird interwoven, like, and this is just the pilot. There's no series yet. They've packed so much into the pilot, like Jackie Earl Haley playing the terror.
Oh, the terror, yes.
Oh, God,
that was wonderful.
Like, it's going to be brilliant, but it's going to be brilliant because Ben Edlin, not only does he lend his voice to this, which it has to have if it's going to be legitimately the Tick, but...
Well, in fact, I think he directs as well, which just makes it even more wonderful, another feather in his cap.
Well, now he absolutely does, because...
Well, I have faith in...
Go ahead, I'm sorry, Catherine.
I have faith in Ben Edlin totally. There's two things that I'm going to, because I know they're going to be listening to this podcast, because they're going to be hearing my voice right now. The two things I need them to do is to not try to introduce all the characters really quickly in the first couple of episodes. String them all out. Spoon feed them to us over the series. That way we have a little surprise, a little something new every time. And I'm begging you, no origin stories.
I think that if this is going to be Edlin's kind of masterpiece of modern superhero television, it's going to end up being a satire of the Netflix type shows, or Arrow, okay, or The Flash. So what I have a feeling you're going to have is a lot of flashbacks, a lot of like tongue-in-cheek flashbacks, a lot of which we've already seen. We already saw those in the pilot. We're going to see like characters being trickled in. You know, I think that this is his as much as the Tick cartoon was kind of his middle finger, as much as the Tick TV show and even the comic was kind of his almost James O'Barr middle finger to the world of comic books. I think that that's what this is going to be, and he's coming back to this after doing, you know, working on Firefly, working on Angel, being part of Mutant Enemy with Joss Whedon and working on, of course, Venture Brothers, working on Supernatural forever, learning how to write linearly, direct, produce, writing for the Clone Wars, writing and producing for Gotham, for Revolution, you know, all of these things he's done now. So now he comes back to executive produce and write this Tick show, and I think that he's going to bring all of that power that he's built coming out of the Tick live-action TV show and the Tick cartoon and writing the Tick comic, plus all this other stuff, and just blow us the hell away. I think it's going to be so far beyond anything we imagine it's going to be that we're going to be put on our ass so hard.
Everything about the production speaks to that brilliantly, because you do get so much that speaks not only to his past, but to how much he's grown as a creator, and that he can come back and drink from the same well and the water is fresher than ever.
And keep in mind, these pilot series are voted on by us, by people that go to Amazon and vote and say, this is the thing that you should make into a season or two of a TV show. And overwhelmingly, The Tick won. So these are people that have, like, Amazon Prime, go vote, you know, spending their money, adults. So this is something that people recognize and want. And I think that's amazing.
Aware of that. How do I go and do that? How do I be a super delegate?
If you go to – if it's too late now. It's already – you've already won.
Well, I mean, but in the future.
If you go to Amazon Prime and you log in to – or go to Amazon and you log into your Amazon account, in the video section during their pilot season, there is, you know, all the shows listed, and you can cast your vote one time for your particular account for which of these shows – you want to see them develop. And
that's good to know.
And that has to be heartening for Ben to know that after all of this time, after all of these iterations, that people will come out in droves and say, this is what I want to see.
This is definitively worth my while.
And he was up against some stiff competition with Jean-Claude Van Johnson. I will tell you that. that was a brilliant concept for a TV show. But this won. So I cannot wait to see what they do with it. I think that we should revisit this. It's after the season is out and we can watch it all. I think that we should revisit this title, the three of us. Maybe as a crossover, like we're so keen on doing, and see.
I'd love to
see what it's like. Do you guys have any final thoughts on The Tick as we wrap this up? How's about Company?
An hour is never enough.
No, it is not. How's about Company? What do you think?
I had a fantastic time. Thanks for having me on. I love being on this program, and I'm so excited about the new Tick. I want it to just get better and better and better and better, and last at least 7 seasons, and not jump the shark.
Well, they'll jump the shark about 17 times. That's the great thing about The Tick, is it's impossible for the tick will literally jump 17 sharks, and you'll be like, why hasn't he jumped the 18th shark yet?
Yeah. They'll jump sharktopus.
Oh my God, could they?
Wow, could they ever?
Oh God, that plays into every fanboy fantasy I've ever had.
Kisses, love you guys.
And Cole, what about you?
Well, I think what's wonderful about The Tick is going back to that unstoppable force, that guy that was on the gridiron, on their makeshift gridiron, that just could not be held down.
Right.
That inspired this character that I think ultimately becomes its own thing, in that The Tick has become an unstoppable force. It was a little obscure independent comic book that then grew and grew and grew, and somebody said, this is worth investing my production money in for Saturday morning. And, you know, the show, the cartoon, lasted several seasons, and it grew and grew, and then someone decided to make it into a live-action series quite brilliantly that unfortunately ran afoul of the network that picked it up. That, you know, could have gone on a lot longer than it did had someone other than Fox, in my opinion, wound up with it. And yet here, like this phoenix from the ashes all these years later, banking heavily on the fact that we're apeshit for nostalgia, you have The Tick yet again.
Well, I think that you're right. You're absolutely right.
The Tick cannot be squashed.
But is it nostalgia, or is it... Because here's the thing about The Tick, with the reinvention of The Tick, with what The Tick is and what Ben Edlund can do,
right.
I think we're starving for new ideas and new content, and The Tick never ceases to provide that. Even with the through line that always exists with The Tick and the city and Arthur and Chairface, still somehow it feels new. It feels like
an
original idea. So, it, you know, I think that it fills a void in which we all know that Arrow is Arrow only because they couldn't get Batman. And they all know you know, and we all like The Flash, but The Flash is The Flash. It's not that original. It's sort of formulaic in the same way that, you know, shows of the X-Files was formulaic. We all love it, but it's a formula. The Tick doesn't adhere to a formula. It is the anti-formula. It is the anti-life equation of comic book shows, and we long for that. We want the weird, no-sense-making, you know, characters like...
You want the Tick treatment.
You want the Tick treatment, exactly. And I think we're going to get the Tick treatment coming up. Guys, this
like
is...
Like the Will Yankovic, for, you know.
No, that's brilliant. That's absolutely what it is. Yes. That's absolutely what
amazing,
it is.
Amazing, though, also, is like you said, you have this, as much as we all hate, like, okay, Spider-Man Homecoming, you know what the one thing you don't need is Spider-Man's origin.
Right.
We don't need to see that again. Yet we can... What's brilliant about Edlin and the Tick is we get the same damn story over and over and over, and we eat it up because it becomes the same story writ new.
Yes, exactly. For sure.
I mean, somehow he makes that work, and I love him and hate him for it simultaneously because that shouldn't be possible, but I love that he makes it possible. And therein lies the real strength of the Tick, is just that enduring quality to just keep coming back and reimagine the same story over again. And it's like going to see the Twilight Zone movie, and half the movie is just remakes the episodes. So there you have it. But we still went and we loved it. So that's my big takeaway from that. And if you get a chance, just track down anything you can on the Tick. It is,
dive into the back issue bins.
Yeah.
Buy up those comics and collect them and read them and love them, and make my collection worth a small fortune.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Cole, why don't you plug us up and we'll get out of here. And also Spoon, by the way, because we haven't said it once this entire show.
Spoon.
So as we spoon on out of here, we are coming to you from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. Also now powered by, this show is now powered by Cinelinks at Cinelinks.com. So you may be finding us any number of places nowadays.
We're everywhere.
Either on Podbean or the Jedi Cole universe.
We're the trees.
Our principal home. On weekends, we go and stay with Dad at Cinelinks.
With your mamas.
Yeah.
I said it.
Now, this is Texas, so you have to assume that we live permanently with Mom.
That's right.
What? Did I just say something about family law in Texas? It's a failed indictment.
Wow.
I could not know. Okay. But look for our tweets on Twitter at the Jedi Cold U. You can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. I already plugged the hell out of the Rancor Pit earlier. So I'm not going to be that shameless and tell you that you can find the Rancor Pit live on watchonairlive.com on the first and third Sundays of every month. And we'll now be broadcast out of the brand new studios in Dallas in the CBS radio building starting on the first Sunday of November. And with that, I'm veg.
Yeah. So why don't we get out of here on a big on three, not after three, but on three, a big spoon, and we will jaunt off into this good night, only to be resurrected next week for another resounding chorus of Hey Kids Comics. So,
and I have had so much fun, by the way, doing this episode and our upcoming Halloween special.
Oh, man.
I don't even remember what's next.
Doesn't matter. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. We got a great show. Think of something. I'm plotted all the way through the end of 2018.
He is. He's like the picture of Dorian Gray, the podcast. All right.
We just add another damn show with the follow-up to this one. So.
That's right. I've got another one, too, that I'm going to pitch to you later, Cole, so don't
worry.
I know. All right. Here we go. 1, 2, 3. Spoon!